Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
On Monday, people are going to elect, but on Sunday already, militaries will be going for election, and then Monday will be for civilians. And talking about the commission readiness, I think everything is set up, everything it is.
Voters will choose a new Chadian president on Monday.
We know that we are definitely going to push this election. The least that we are expecting is to push this election to a runoff, because it is going to be a change in administration. And we are taking our campaign activities in terms of strategy and tactics to winning. Nobody enters a race without the intentions of winning.
A Namibian presidential candidate promises to create 500,000 jobs. We'll have details.
And I think the thing that I'm most excited about is being able to say at the end of the 3 days that we had some of the best discussions and dialogues and created the best platform possible for those who really have an interest and a stake in Africa.
And seven African leaders confirm participation in a three-day U.S.-Africa business summit that begins on Monday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Chad, voters will choose a new president on Monday. On the eve of the poll, personnel from state security organizations are voting on Sunday, according to officials of the Electoral Commission. Analysts say transitional president Mohamed Idriss Deby is the major favorite to win, but he faces competition from former exiled opposition leader Suse Masra, who is the current interim prime minister, and former prime minister Albert Pahimi Padaki. Lagadi Moltong is a project developer in Chad. I reached him to talk about the readiness of the Electoral Commission to administer the poll, the expectations of the people of Chad, and key issues citizens want the new president to resolve.
On Monday, people are going to elect, but on Sunday already, militaries will be going for election, and then Monday will be for civilians. And talking about the commission readiness, I think everything is set up, everything is in place, and just waiting. As voters enrollment have happened a couple months already, and now I think people are ready just to go on Monday and then vote.
What are their expectations?
Talking about expectations, I think these elections are quite a bit different from the ones we used to have, because now there is a coalition of many other parties going with one candidate, and then we know the other. I think it will be playing between two main candidates, the current transitional president and also the transformators candidate. I think the game will be played among these two candidates. And people expectations, young people are expecting for change, and a lot of people are expecting for change, and also we have this kind of other side of people who are still kind of nostalgic to the old system, and they would like to keep going with the old system. So it depends on which side you are, but in my opinion, these are the expectations.
So you don't think the opposition coalition would have any significant impact in the race between Prime Minister Suse Masra and transitional president Deby?
Yeah, I think actually the challenge will be between those two candidates. Yeah, because as you can see, going through the campaigns now, those are the main candidates that are raising crowds, and you can see definitely through the last 2 weeks when people were running, to the countryside, and I think the game will be played within those two candidates.
Did the Electoral Commission say when it will release the final results of the election?
So last time the Electoral Commission said a statement that they are the only institution that should decide when the result is coming out. So I think for now, I don't know if they have enough of resources to declare the winning candidate as soon as possible after the elections. But as they said, they're the one that have authority to decide to declare the final results. So it's difficult to predict.
What are the two major issues that the people of Chad want the next leader to resolve?
I think two major issues. First of all, when we talk about fighting poverty, that means people basically need like education, health. I think the second issue would be mainly about infrastructures. Security, for sure. Also security, because we have a lot of internal security issues like the herder farmers conflicts, and all these. And I think this is one of the major security, like kidnapping against here issues that I think Chadians would like to change. And things like power, electricity and water, those will be among the things that Chadians would like to see the next president to improve or to change definitely.
You've spoken to some people. How enthusiastic are they to choose the next president on Monday?
I think excitement. That I'm talking, there are two gatherings. One at the public place, and the other one at the sport arena, where the two, as I said, the Prime Minister Sixe Masra and the President Mahamat Idriss Deby are now giving their last speech before the election. So people are excited. You can see all over in the city. This is something new. Before, people were like they knew nothing would change, but now there's a real challenge between the candidates, and people are really excited. I think people will go out and vote.
Lagari Moltong is a project developer in Chad. He spoke with me from the Chadian capital, N'Djamena. She is the only female independent presidential candidate to contest in the coming general election in Namibia. Ali Angula, who has both a private and public business background, promises to create 500,000 jobs within the next 3 years. But critics say the number of jobs she promises to create is unrealistic. They also say it appears to be a gimmick to score political points in the run-up to the general election scheduled for November 27. Angula, however, disagrees. She maintains that she is the only candidate who has a track record of creating jobs. She adds that with that knowledge and pedigree, she will implement measures to boost employment. For more about her electoral prospects and how Namibians are embracing her campaign, I reach Ali Angula.
People are responding very, very well because they are getting to engage with the fact that for the first time, besides having a female independent presidential candidate, we actually have somebody who's come in from business. We've got somebody who's got public sector experience in addition to coming in from business. And we are taking solutions to the Namibian people that they so dearly need. So they are responding amazingly well and receiving the programs and the campaign promises very, very well.
Realistically, what do you think your electoral prospects are to becoming the next president of Namibia, especially following your launch and how people have embraced you?
When we started, I started a year ago when I made the announcement on the 1st of May. Everybody thought it was a joke. And the joke was, no, it's you're going to be voting for yourself and maybe your family members. And then 6 months into it, it grew to maybe 2% of the Namibian people are going to be voting for you. But in terms of the response that we are getting from the election promises and the election declarations that we've made, we know that we are definitely going to push this election. The least that we are expecting is to push this election to a runoff because it is going to be a change in administration. And we are taking our campaign activities in terms of strategy and tactics to winning. Nobody enters a race without the intentions of winning. and that is our intention, is to win.
What makes you confident that you will pose any significant political threat to the ruling SWAPO party that has dominated Namibian politics since independence?
Namibia is different in the sense that when Namibians are tired of a thing, they are tired of a thing. Unlike South Africa, for instance, where the ANC has progressively, every election, lost 4%, Namibia is different in the sense that SWAPO in the last election, 2019, lost their two-third majority. And we anticipate that in these elections, because these elections are really about bread and butter issues, and they don't have an economic narrative. Namibians are economically deprived. We've got a high level of unemployment. And what makes me different is the fact that I'm the only one out of all the candidates that has ever created jobs with my own capacity, started a factory, have been in agriculture, commercial farming, the only black female commercial farmer in potatoes and onions. And people are resonating with that story because they know this is the person who knows what she's doing. And we're not talking about things that I haven't done. And that's the difference. We are very, very confident in the prospects and outcome of these elections.
Talking about bread and butter issues, you promised to create 500,000 new jobs over the next 3 years. But some of your critics, including some economists, are saying this is just a mere wishful thinking and not realistic. Your response to that?
So what I'm proposing is to match our public goods needs in terms of infrastructure to the people that are out there daily looking for jobs. There's a program I'm calling the Rural Residence Infrastructure Construction Program, which is going to deliver immediately 100,000 jobs. So Namibia is experiencing a drought. We experience a drought every 3 years. And the reason why we are so exposed is because we've got no water harvesting capacity. We haven't built that capacity. And we are left to the elements, and people are having to rely on rainwater. And Namibia is a very, very dry country. So what we are doing is we are saying we require water infrastructure. We require piping to people's fields. We require to be digging earth dams. And all I'm doing is taking our capital budget and saying we need people that need jobs, and I'm matching the capital budget and the needs of the Namibian people in terms of infrastructure to the people that are seeking for jobs. So it's really not rocket science. It's not rocket science. It's diverting money to where we need to put the money, and it is employing people that need to be employed. We also have a need of 2,136 classrooms around the country. We've got BTST graduates. These are graduates that are coming out of our vocational schools that are unemployed. So we are matching the BTC graduate who's got the skill and has the talent but doesn't have the opportunity, because we've been tendering out work, and our tenders and capital budget spend has been going to foreign companies. And we've been exporting money. Government of Namibia has been exporting money. And I'm saying for the first time under my administration, there's not going to be 1 cent that is going to be paid out of the Namibian government bank account going into a foreign bank account of another company, because we need those money here and we need to develop Namibia.
Ali Angula is an independent presidential candidate. She spoke with me from the Namibian capital, Windhoek. In Zambia, the founder and coordinator of the Free Press Initiative is calling for legal reforms that will allow media practitioners to do their work without intimidation or harassment from the authorities and supporters of political parties. Joan Chirwa says although there have been gains in press freedom, more needs to be done to ensure the protection of journalists from extreme political party supporters. Her remarks came during World Press Freedom Day. It was a day, Chirwa also says, for genuine reflection on the status of press freedom in the Southern African country. For more about the situation in Zambia, I read Joan Chirwa in the capital, Lusaka.
World Press Freedom Day is such an important day. And for Zambia, it's a day that gives us an opportunity to see what has been done and also look at what could be done better maybe, and also reflect on where we want to be in terms of that press freedom, which is quite essential for the country and for the democracy itself, which, you know, as you know, Zambia is known to be one of the countries that have been praised by many when it comes to adhering to the principles of democracy. And the press cannot be taken out of the equation. We play quite a key role in that area.
Joan, talking about reflections, some Zambian journalists I have spoken with have expressed concern that there appears to be a slight decrease in press freedom, and that, you know, governments, not this particular one, but previous governments have putting in measures, or supporters have intimidated, you know, the press to the extent that the gains that they anticipated having appear to be dwindling down. Your take?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, when we talk about where we were, recall that it's in the previous administration that left in 2021 when the Post was closed, and that's a newspaper that I worked for as managing editor. And it was in that administration again when we had Prime Television closed, and a few other radio stations had their licenses suspended. Apart from that, we had quite a number of incidences where journalists were intimidated, they were attacked by ruling party cadres. But of course, there are some journalists that have been arrested and charged with some serious criminalities simply for publishing something which is a right that journalists do. We have Thomas Liambo, who was arrested last December. I'm not too sure if you're aware of that. And was charged with sedition for publishing some material on an online platform. And a few others have also had issues, especially to do with the Cyber Security Act. So, yes, there could be a bit of an improvement, but that doesn't mean we are where we need to be in terms of press freedom, because we have these laws that are existing and still so much against the free practice of journalism. So it raises concerns, and when we talk about these laws, I think what we should begin to do now is to call for total reforms to ensure that we create an environment that will see journalists practicing freely without having to fear them, because that is the biggest problem right now.
Does that mean that your organization, the Press Freedom Initiative, will engage stakeholders, including the government, to ensure there's more free press, or journalists are not harassed or threatened in their line of work?
Yeah, we have done that before. In most of the work that we do, that engagement is one of the key factors to it. In terms of the legal reforms, those are things that we have actually lined up for the short term, or in the short term, where we want to find ways in which we can engage the government seriously, and then look at those existing laws and find ways in which we can appeal to them to incorporate them in the process of them putting across the legal reforms that have already been started. I had mentioned the cybersecurity law, which at the moment we have a bill, but it hasn't been tabled in the National Assembly yet. I know now we have been talking about access to information, which unfortunately would look like, oh, it's everything else that maybe journalists needed, but that's not correct. The other amendments that I can talk about is the repeal of the defamation of the president law, which was contained in the Penal Code. It's no longer there. But that's just a tiny component of the several other laws that are existing.
Joan Chiroa is the founder and coordinator of the Free Press Initiative. She spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
At VOA's Our Voices table, we are bringing women's voices to the conversation.
At the Our Voices table, we bring what matters to hearts and minds of women.
You hear insightful opinions and expertise on things that impact and change women's lives.
We hear your voices, women's voices, our voices.
Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
Seven African leaders have confirmed participation in a three-day U.S.-Africa Business Summit 2024 in Dallas, Texas. The conference, which is organized by the Corporate Council on Africa, is from Monday, May 6 to 9. Florizel Lizier, President and CEO of the Corporate Council on Africa, tells VOA the summit provides a major platform for deepening U.S.-Africa business ties across key sectors, including agribusiness, energy, health, infrastructure, trade, facilitation, ICT, and finance. She tells me that the summit also brings together over 1,500 U.S. and African public and private sector executives. She adds that the three-day conference provides networking opportunities, facilitation meetings between U.S. and African private sector executives, government representatives, investors, and entrepreneurs. Here is the conclusion of the conversation.
What are your expectations of this three-day summit?
Oh, my goodness. So my expectations are high, of course. So first of all, I am looking forward to welcoming to Dallas, along with the Dallas Summit Committee, Welcome Committee, these heads of state that are coming. I hope I get them all right, but we have them from Angola, Botswana, Cape Verde, Liberia, I think we have Malawi, we have Mauritius, and I'm sure I'm missing some, and so my team will kill me, but we've got these heads of state that are coming. We also have a couple of vice president of Nigeria is going to be with us. So, you know, we're very excited about that. And then at the head of the U.S. delegation is Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield, who, as you know, is the U.S. ambassador to UN. But we also have Chair Rita Jo Lewis, chairman of the U.S. Export-Import Bank. We have CEO Alice Albright coming from Millennium Challenge Corporation. We have the head of the U.S. Trade and Development Agency coming, Eno Ebong. And so, you know, all across the USG. And I think the thing that I'm most excited about is being able to say at the end of the 3 days that we had some of the best discussions and dialogues and created the best platform possible for those who really have an interest and a stake in Africa. We also have, you know, Secretary General Wamkele Mene, who's the head of the African Continental Free Trade Area Secretariat coming. We have a video that's coming from my sister Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, from, you know, the Director General of the WTO. She's going to weigh in on some things. We have a video that's coming from Secretary Raimondo, from Secretary of Commerce. So we're just very excited about the dialogue that will happen across those 3 days and the seeds that will be planted for the kinds of investment returns and crop and harvest, the investment harvest that we will see over the next months and years.
Well, you initially mentioned some of the positive feedbacks that you've gotten and some of the fruits that have germinated as a result. But how enthusiastic have these leaders been to embracing this platform and taking advantage of it to the benefit of their people back home?
Well, you know, I think that despite the narrative that people have that, you know, Africa doesn't, you know, that the risks are too high, the perception of risk in Africa is really not aligned with the reality. And of course, there are risks in investing in emerging markets. That's true anywhere in the world. But, you know, there are also these tools that help mitigate the risk. The kinds of insurance that's available, the kind of guarantees that are available. You know, our thought is that we need to continue to dispel the myths about Africa, and we need to make sure that people have on a lens that sees the tremendous opportunities of Africa, one of them being the African Continental Free Trade Area, where you have 1.3 billion people, you know, a $3.4 trillion combined GDP economy, all as one huge market where the barriers to trade, both tariff and non-tariff barriers, have been eliminated, and where they are putting in place different protocols, like they just adopted the digital trade protocol, which is incredible. You know, the WTO has been trying to pass the e-commerce work for, you know, maybe, you know, 15, 20 years, and unfortunately hasn't had the success that we wanted. I'm not a WTO basher. I think they're doing, you know, a lot, but I commend the Africans for what they're doing through the African Continental Free Trade Area. It's a game changer, not only for how the Africans will trade with each other, but for how they will serve as global partners for the United States and others. So I'm just focused on the United States.
Florizia Lizier is president and CEO of the Corporate Council on Africa. She spoke with me from Dallas, Texas. Africa on the Avenue will be celebrated on May 18 in Washington, D.C. It is planned to be a celebration of the vibrant African immigrant community in the heart of America's capital that will be held at Bruce Monroe Park, 3012 Georgia Avenue Northwest. The celebration is sponsored by District Bridges, a U.S.-based community development and NGO working to bridge community engagement and economic development opportunities to nurture equitable and resilient communities in D.C. and beyond. Charlie Walker is the manager at District Bridges. I sat down with her at the VOA studios to talk about the coming Africa on the Avenue celebration.
For this event, Africa on the Avenue, we are doing a partnership with the Mayor's Office on African Affairs. So this was my personally first time working with them. They have been amazing so far, and they will have a table to say hey to everyone at Africa on the Avenue this year.
Talk to me about the Africa on the Avenue. How did it begin, and how did you get involved with it?
Yes. So it was created just off of the idea of wanting to embrace and highlight African immigrant culture along Georgia Avenue. So that's why this event happens on Georgia Avenue. It's getting big. So some folks say, why not move it? And we created it, we birthed it to highlight the African businesses on Georgia Avenue. So each year we continue to hold it on Georgia Avenue. And this year I'm super excited because we have a lot of different new aspects for it. We'll have music, good food, of course. We'll have some African dancers. We'll have a map where you can learn a little bit more about the different African countries. We'll have a hand wrap demonstration, hula hoops, double dutch. All of those things will be wrapped in beautiful African fabric. So we have a lot of different things going on. We try to make it so anybody can come, any member of the family can partake in the activities that are happening. And we just want to make it a fun event where residents can commute with the residents can connect with the small businesses and the different African vendors that we have to learn a little more about each other.
The African vendors here in D.C. on Georgia Avenue, how enthusiastic are they to be part of it? And what are the prospects of business opportunities for these businesses on Georgia Avenue?
Well, they're super excited to be a part of it. I think when you highlight it, you can share a little bit about your background and your culture to different folks who might not know. It's super exciting. It will also bring foot traffic to Georgia Avenue. I think the biggest thing as a small business is getting funds to make sure you're able to pay your bills and things like that. So when we host this large event, it brings so many different residents throughout the city to the corridor where they can learn about the new folks that's coming in, and they can encourage them to come back and visit me past this event. So they're super excited to share whatever it is they're going to be selling, t-shirts, juices, sauces, whatever it is that they're going to have, to share that with the community in hopes that they can retain them, make friendships, build bonds, that they will come and shop with them outside of the event.
Any commitment from the Mayor's Office on African Affairs who participate in these events?
I think their biggest concern is just making sure that African culture is at the center of the event. And that's what we try to accomplish on all different levels. As far as making sure we have all the flags when you walk up, you know that this is a true African event. As far as the vendors and things like that, we seek out vendors, we seek out decorations, we seek out entertainment, all centered around the African community. And I think that was super big for them. And it's kind of what built this partnership, because it's super big for us at DistroBridges.
Are the vendors restricted to only those in D.C. or surrounding areas like the DMV, the Maryland, you know, area close to D.C. or the Virginia area close to D.C. or strictly businesses in D.C., African businesses in D.C.? Is that a criteria?
We start to try to highlight African businesses along Georgia Avenue,
right,
in D.C. That's who we try to target. Now, if we don't meet like our quota of how many vendors we want to have, then of course we were open up the opportunities. But I think being in D.C., me helping small businesses in D.C., D.C. will probably always be the central focus of highlighting those African businesses. And there's so many African immigrants in D.C.
Charlie Walker is the manager at DistroBridges. She spoke with me from here in Washington. The average income of people around the world will be cut by one-fifth because of climate change by the middle of the century, according to a new report by Germany's Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, published in the journal Nature. For VOA, Henry Ridgewell has more.
In the Philippines this week, schools were closed as students and teachers were ordered to stay at home amid temperatures close to 40 degrees Celsius. As many parts of the world experience extreme weather, new research warns that the global impacts of a changing climate are set to cost $38 trillion a year by 2050. That means a reduction in the world's average income of some 19%. Those losses are locked in, says report co-author Maximilian Kotz.
What we find is that over the next 25 to 30 years, impacts on the economy are consistent across different emission scenarios, regardless of whether we enter a high emission or a low emission world.
Climate change, and especially higher temperatures, have been shown to impact worker productivity, says Kotz.
And that's going to then be manifest across numerous different industries. Although it's particularly strong, those impacts when workers are outdoors, so in contexts like manufacturing sectors. And then we also know that impacts on agricultural productivity are very strong from, again, particularly high temperatures.
The research looked at climate and economic data from the past 40 years from more than 1,600 regions across the world and used it to assess future impacts. Those least responsible for global emissions are likely to be worst hit.
Regions in the global south are those which are most vulnerable and which are going to be most strongly affected by future climate change. And the simple reason for that is that these regions, they're already hotter.
The report concludes that tackling climate change would be far cheaper than putting up with the economic damage. It says the cost of reducing greenhouse gas emissions would be just a sixth of the $38 trillion impact of climate change by 2050. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Pete, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The first 8 teams to have qualified for the Paris 2024 Olympic Games in each of the 5 disciplines being contested for at the World Athletics Relay Bahamas 2024 have been confirmed following the opening day of competition in Nassau. Botswana, Nigeria, and South Africa picked up one spot each in the men's 4x400 meters, while Nigeria had the team qualifying for the mixed 4x400 meters relay. Some of the members of the Nigerian mixed 4x400 meters relay team were excited over their qualification for the Paris Olympic Games.
Really good. A physical qualifier is a great time and it's in a great position. And you want them to qualify because we've been working and God is not by us. So anyone just going to do his thing for us, and here we are.
14 teams in the women's and men's 4x100 meters and 4x400 meters plus the mixed 4x400 meters in Nassau this weekend will automatically qualify 4 places at the Paris Olympics. In football news, the first phase of the CAF B Diploma Coaching Course, which got underway at the Grimstein Stadium, South Africa, ended on Sunday with 25 coaches hoping to attain their CAF B licensed coaching badges in the course of the year. The coaches are expected to finish the course after 3 phases in July. South Africa Football Association President Danny Jordan said with these scores, SAFA aims to accelerate coaches' education to reduce the widening gap of coaches to player ratio in South Africa.
We used to have one coach for every 200 players. We need to come down. If we want to be equal to Germany and Spain, to have one qualified coach with a license or professional license for every 20 players, and that is a tall order.
In basketball news, the Basketball Africa League got underway on Saturday at the Dakar Arena, where 4 contenders will fight for the remaining 3 spots for the playoffs scheduled to take place later this month in Kigali, Rwanda. The 4 teams will play each of their 3 opponents twice over the course of the 9-day competition. An exceptional performance by American point guard Obadiah Nuor inspired APR Basketball Club of Rwanda to a stunning 89-84 victory over Tunisian giant US Monastery in the opening game of the Sahara Conference. Rivers Hoopers of Nigeria earned a hot 77-68 win over host AS Douanes in the other game. APR will be back in action on Sunday against the Rivers Hoopers of Nigeria, while AS Douanes will face US Monastery. And on to rugby, where South Africa, Kenya, Madagascar and Cameroon on Saturday began their quest for Women's Rugby World Cup 2025 qualification in Antananarivo, Madagascar on Saturday. The Kenyan national rugby women team, the Lionesses, lost their opening match of the Rugby Africa Women's Cup 22-29 to host Madagascar. The Lionesses will face rivals South Africa in their next match before playing Cameroon in their last match of the tournament on Sunday. And that's it for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Evening, Africa. Without much drama, no exaggerated claims that they are practicing robust diplomacy, President Xi Jinping's China is emerging as the global reconciler to resolve pressing international issues. In this regard, with special reference to the Middle East, China has taken the steps to tackle 2 main problems that have made resolution of a just and lasting peace in Middle East difficult. The first is the ancient division in the Muslim community. Nothing really that is unknown in global history, because from the 16th century to the 19th, Christendom was split, and that split between the Reformationist and Catholic produced 100 years war in Europe, toppled democracies or royalties, and there were also wars of succession involving who should be the successor to the throne. And in the case of the Middle East, the issue dividing the Sunni and Shia Muslims have become prominent. The second issue is the division between the Palestinians, which makes it very difficult to have a unified Palestinian front in any peace resolution. China, taking note of this split between Shia and Sunni, and that way that it has been weaponized by those who want to be involved in the Middle East, China reconcile the dispute between more or less the 2 branches, Saudi Arabia, which has historical claims to Muslim Holy Land, and the issue of Iran, particularly after Khomeini left his exile in France and arrived in Tehran to oust the Shah of Iran. That attempt succeeded, and today Saudi Arabia and Iran have their embassies in each other's country, and it was the hope that this reconciliation between Iran and Saudi Arabia will produce a favorable result to solve the Yemen problem. This week it was announced that Palestinian factions have been meeting in Beijing with Chinese officials. The attempt was to bring about a reconciliation between the Palestinians. Many others have tried in vain to reconcile them. But the result that we heard after the meetings in Beijing is that the signs are very hopeful. And one must understand the reason for the division between the Palestinians. In the early years of the disputes from the partition to Oslo, there was common stand by all the Palestinians. The opposition to what was called the Israeli, not the Israeli state actually, or the Zionist entity was formed. But Oslo agreement brought about a split when Fatah, the main group under the leadership of Arafat, recognized the state of Israel, something that many Arab states and powers had never done before. That is why it is so bitter, because Hamas is not that it's against the Jewish state now, but that there could be only a Jewish state when a Palestinian state has been established in conformity with United Nations two-state solution. So Arafat jumping rope annoyed many Palestinian factions. So this is what President Xi and China are trying to resolve. And if they succeed, it will be much more difficult for those who don't wish the Palestinians well to divide and rule or to weaponize the Shia Sunni splits as well as the division among the Palestinians. This is why the role that China is playing in reconciliation of parties involved in pressing international disputes is widely welcome. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Life keeps moving on. Ah!
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer Justin Thwaite, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if creeping plants can unite, they could tie up an elephant. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.